Hey everybody, it's Sunny. If you have ever loved this show, you really got to go sign up for the Patreon at subbeacon.com because we have a bonus episode that you're going to just I hesitate to say things like this, but I think it's probably one or two best shows we've ever done. Just on a crazy weekend experienced by Vic and Sunny and JBL. It's an hour long bonus episode. We talked a long time. It is pure uncut dudes chatting. So if you're here for the movies, this won't necessarily be one for you, but I thought it was a great episode. Subbeacon.com. It's always going to be on the Patreon. Never will be here on iTunes, which is where you're listening right now. This episode's about Death on the Nile. We also pay tribute to the great PJ O'Rourke, who passed away a couple weeks ago. So again, it's a couple weeks old. You would have gotten this in real time if you signed up at subbeacon.com. You should do that. So anyway, we'll see you over there at subbeacon.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the newlyweds, Mr. and Mrs. Simon Doyle.
You must meet Hercule Poirot.
My congratulations, madame.
Merci.
He's only the greatest detective alive.
I suspect you invited me for reasons other than the fun. You had
something to hide. We have the Karnak all to ourselves, a chef and enough champagne to fill the Nile. Should have hidden
it, shouldn't you? When you have money, no one is ever really your friend.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Subbeacon. I'm Victor Mattis, along with Jonathan V. Last and Sunny Bunch. Just a reminder, the Subbeacon is now available through Patreon. Go to subbeacon.com, you'll easily find us. Please subscribe, tell your friends, and don't forget about the Subbeacon merchandise store at tpublic.com. Gentlemen, how are we? Normally, we go into how is our weekend, what's going on. But of course, 2 days ago now, I guess we had learned that our good friend PJ O'Rourke had passed. And I think that this might be a good opportunity for us to share some reflections on PJ, a friend and an amazing writer, and what he meant, and memories of him and his writing. Sonny.
I didn't want to have to start this fucking fuck. I'm the youngest of the group, obviously.
That's why I'm going in age order.
Yeah. So part, you know, he was already a very well established, multiple books, best selling books. Author by the time I was like even reading him, to the extent that like my dad read him in Rolling Stone, like as a younger, as a younger person, and had essentially it had subscribed to Rolling Stone for many years. Like we would get it delivered to our house wherever we lived, and like on the off chance that we would get a PJ or work reported piece. And that is the kind of writer he was. I mean, that is like the sort of, the sort of adoration that he had. I mean, the books, they speak for themselves, Parliament of Whores and Give War a Chance, et cetera, et cetera. I have always had a very soft spot for his book about Adam Smith. He basically did a close read of Adam Smith's, and now I'm spacing on the name of the actual book, but of what PJ's book was, but it's really good, and it's just like very funny and smart and all that stuff. I mean, I was not friends with him.
Did you ever meet him when you were at the Standard?
So this is what I want. This is how I'm trying to transition into this, because I hate people who are like, here's my hanging out with this famous person, and he told me how great I was one time over drink. But, like, he never said that about me, for the record.
There's a real art to that, by the way.
But there, and
the humble brag over it.
There are people we know who are very, very good at that.
Oh, man.
Well, I won't name any names. We won't name any names. But there was
one time at the Standard, at the Weekly Standard, and I had had the you know, opportunity to correspond with him on stuff he had written for the back of the book, you know, just sending edits back and forth and trading emails. And he would actually fax over, I believe, still the – this was when he was still faxing over the, like, typed out manuscripts.
Yes.
And I would have to – I would then type it and put it into the – and we would send it back.
I think we've all been there, yeah.
Very funny. But
kids
I remember
listening to this are going to hear that story, and it is going to make about as much sense as the old telephones.
Right.
When you would pick up and you'd say to the operator, I'd like Brookstone 425.
Right. Give me Long Island.
726.
As Michael Corleone says, give me Long Island. Anyway, go ahead. Long Beach.
Yeah, so this is actually, I mean, it is like just something to think about. He was a writer who came up of in a time when it was routine to write something and then fax it in, and it would be typeset, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this was, I was working at the Standard between 2005 and 2008. We had email. He could have emailed it, but he was not an emailer. So anyway, I remember once Richard Starr came around, was like, he was going up to people and was like, hey, come with me. And he came up to my desk. He was like, Sonny, come with me. I was like, okay. And we wound up going to the University Club, I believe it was, with Andy and Andy Ferguson, mm-hmm. Maybe Matt Labash, I can't remember. And PJ O'Rourke was there. And it was just one of these, like, very surreal.
Yes.
Like, it's the reason you pay assistant editor so little is because every once in a while they get to go out and have cocktails with PJ O'Rourke. Here
and
is
he
my
looked
one...
at you over cocktails and he said, Sonny, that was a hell of a piece you wrote last week.
I loved your
review of Drillbit Taylor.
I loved your essay on Orson Welles. No, that's one of the handful of times I met him. It was great. It was fun. I don't have any particularly fantastic stories to tell about it, except it was just like he was great to have drinks with. Here's my one PJ story. So when I was working at the Standard for my father's birthday one year, I was like, I had purchased a used copy of Give War a Chance, and I sent PJ an email. He did use email occasionally. I sent him an email and I said, hey, you know, we met, but I was hoping I could send you this copy of the book to sign for my dad. It's his birthday. It's his, you know, he loves you. He has read all your stuff, blah, blah, blah. And you know, I'll send a self-addressed stamped envelope. You just sign it and send it back. It'd be great. Really appreciate it. I send this email, and then like 10 minutes later, I get a call at my desk. I'm like, hey, Sonny. Hello, this is Sonny Bunch. Sonny, this is PJ. I was like, oh, okay. I just got your email. Don't send a book. That's ridiculous. I will just go get one out of my library and send it. Now, what is your dad's name? What should I say to him? And like, so it was like, this was a million times better because it's like, here you go, Dad. Yeah. Here for your birthday is this book out of PJ O'Rourke's library that he has personally signed to you. Blah blah blah. And eventually, he at one of the Deadly Virtue, either Deadly Virtues or it wasn't Dadly Virtues.
Christmas Virtues.
Maybe it was Christmas Virtues. Did he write for Christmas Virtues?
Yes.
Yeah. So in the Christmas, I think it was the Christmas Virtues one, which I also had an essay in that JBL edited. My dad actually came up to DC and PJ was there. He was part of the panel, and I think. Got to meet him and blah. So it's like the only time I've ever actually impressed my father is through PJ O'Rourke. That is my PJ. But the point of the story is that like PJ O'Rourke, the nicest person I have ever encountered in any aspect of the business, nicest, absolute gent, very very decent. J-Pod had a story about this in his. In his obituary about, you know, getting a piece of the Berlin Wall from PJ. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he was just like a fundamentally decent person. And this is a business that does not give rise to a lot of fundamentally decent people.
Yeah.
It gives rise to a lot of people who are like, how can I, you know, use this relationship to get to the next thing? And he, I mean, he may have been like that. He may have been like that in other, but he was not the sort of, he was not the sort of person to ever look askance at a young writer or a young person or just like a nobody and tell them to, you know, screw off and get out of here. Decent guy, great writer. And those are like the two of the nicest things you can say about a writer. That's
somebody, somebody left a comment on the Bulwarks website. I wrote a little thing about PJ, sharing their own PJ story. And this guy said, I grew up in New Hampshire, like two towns over from PJ, and I was obsessed with him. And it was like 25 years ago, my senior year in high school, I was taking a journalism class. And I just had this idea, like, what if we asked PJ Rourke to come and talk to our class? And so he went to the phone book, and there was PJ Rourke just listed. And his teacher said, yeah, if you want to call him, and if he agrees to do it. So he calls him. PJ answers the phone, and he's like, hi, my name is Steve. Would you come and talk to us over at Stonewall High School? And PJ goes, yeah, sure, like next Wednesday. And that's just it. And he like comes over, and he said the most surreal moment of his life was while they were waiting to go into class, they went to sit in the cafeteria, and he bought PJ a chocolate milk. You remember the little Tuscan carton chocolate milk?
Sure. Yeah.
And he like whipped out his 50 cents and bought a chocolate milk for PJ. And they just sat there and hung out for 15 minutes before going in. And PJ just, you know, our business is filled with assholes. Mm-hmm. And they all live to 100.
No, and, by the way, before, you know, I just want to say when you're talking about emailing with PJ, he had an AOL email. And but you know who else did was Charles Krauthammer, by the way, as a side note. And do you remember what his AOL email was? I forget the number because it wasn't one. It wasn't one, but it was like Pundit 03 or something, or Pundit 07. And I wanted to know who was one through six.
Pundit 01 was Robert Novak.
Oh, right. Ah, I can't believe he took it. Right.
Pundit 02 German, was Jack Germond.
Right. Okay, anyway, JVL.
So there is, I think there's a real dividing line, and it runs right between Sonny and us in terms of people's relationship to PJ. Mm-hmm. Because a little bit, not quite us, but a little bit above us age-wise, you get to people who viewed PJ as an exemplar and somebody for whom you could aspire to be. And for us, and for Sonny too, like that was really unattainable. Like, you know,
because the world had passed.
That world had passed, and that's what I wanted to. That's what I think the difference is. It isn't about PJ. It's that the world which allowed PJ Rourke to have a career is gone. You know, writing long form for Rolling Stone, Playboy. Forbes,
yeah,
FYI.
Playboy. I was wanting to write for Playboy.
Car and Driver. He was writing long form pieces for Car and Driver.
Yeah.
Right. That doesn't exist anymore. You can't. Nobody. Forbes, FYI, which I believe at the time was edited by Chris Buckley, sent PJ to Kyrgyzstan for like 2 weeks or something. Can you imagine like trying to get the expense account? The idea is like I have this great writer and I would simply like to pay to send them to place X and let them write something great about it.
And then you'd have to figure out, you know, the expenses when they came back. But that was always a running joke. I mean, you saw that in the French Dispatch, by the way.
He got,
by the way, Car and Driver paid him once in the form of a Land Rover.
That's so great.
It was a nice big Hunter Green. Anyway, JVL, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so that universe is gone. And PJ was, I did the math on it. I mean, PJ was like a big, famous superstar when we were in high school.
Yeah,
like
I didn't realize he was
name
as old as he was.
You know what? Part of it is just he was sandy-haired. And guys with sandy hair always look younger.
And also,
than
boyish
they,
haircut.
They
he had a boyish
haircut.
Haircut,
sandy hair. Yeah. And he had his kids real late in life.
He did.
And he's got three kids. I think his son, his youngest, is a senior in high school. So, these things do keep you young. This hit me harder than I thought it would. Maybe because I was surprised. I hadn't known he was sick. Yeah. I was not super close to PJ. You know, we knew each other mm-hmm. a very little bit. We hung out a few times. I think I'm the only person who ever hung out with PJ more than three times who never drank with him.
That's shocking.
What?
And very weird.
Well, he drank, but that's
I was going to say, no, I can't do that. That's why we don't do that.
I don't. It's me, not a him thing. But he's, you know, if more people in our business were like him, everything would be different.
You know, aren't. JVL, what it is, and you just mentioned this at the outset. There are people who are outwardly really nice and friendly and hilarious and funny, and then when you get to know them, they turn out to be assholes, you know. And it's like, oh, I wish I didn't know you. And then there are other people who, you know, like PJ had such a vicious wit, you know, and he was a master of satire and poking fun of people, deservedly so, but could not have been a nicer guy. I much prefer that.
Yeah.
Well, but here's the other, you know, so I will compare him to, so John, who's listening to the show right now, John Podhoretz is crunchy on the outside, but soft on the inside, right? I mean, John presents this exterior of like, rah, but the truth is he is a prince among men. PJ's exterior and interior were in harmony, right? I mean, he just looked like this sweetheart and gentleman, and he was.
Yeah.
And
JVL, what was it like editing him? I think you have done more actual editing of PJ than anybody else.
No, I bet Vic has edited PJ more than I have.
You are actually working directly without any interference from other editors.
Yeah, it's a joy.
His copy is good. Right? Yeah. He had weird tics. You know, I mean, there were things that he would get wrong with misspellings and type. I mean, it was very weird, but the form was all there. It was just easy to fix. You know what I mean? There's things you can clean up, but, you know, you didn't have to worry about moving. You weren't going to move things around. Because,
structure.
Like,
there was no
structural issues. Structurally sound. You just had to fix little corners and things. That's okay. You know, yeah. Misspellings,
and
some
he was
weird things.
Easy with it in the way that Vic, I'm sure you would say, right? And,
all
of our experience, is it fair to say the best writers are the easiest edits?
Yeah, and it's sometimes funny because sometimes bad writers or inexperienced writers can be the worst, can be the fussiest. They'll push back, even though they've been barely published anywhere, but they'll push back about their... It's a weird thing. And whereas PJ is like, sure this, sure that, whatever.
So my personal policy on this with young writers, a young writer who is a dick to edit... Mm. My policy has always been to, the minute they start acting like an asshole... I just stop editing them. I say, great, okay, we'll publish it right as is. Great. And then they go on the list that I keep.
Oh, sure.
Because I keep a list. And they are never published again.
You know.
Like, I won't spend another 30 seconds trying to improve their copy. I'll send them their pay. And then they literally go on the no-fly list that I keep. And never, ever published again.
You know what's hilarious is there might be listeners out there like, wait a minute. I haven't published there in ages. Oh, no. Realize that they're on the list. It sounds very JVL, but in fact, it's a very editor thing to do. The Journal does this apparently, where if you're the person responsible for gumming up the works because you filed late or you missed a deadline, you get put on a list.
Yeah.
You know, there should be lists.
There should be public lists.
Put
up at the New York Times headquarters, just on the walls, like the 95 theses or whatever. I actually had an issue with a writer. I won't name him, but I was like, this line doesn't work for the piece. And this like second line right after it doesn't really work either. I want to take him out. And he like haggled with me for like four emails. I was just like, I like your writing, but you've got to stop. You've got to knock it off.
Right. We're trying to make it better. We're not just doing this because we enjoy doing this.
And I would say also from the other side of the table, mm-hmm. as a writer, my policy with editors, if I get a bad editor, mm-hmm. I don't haggle with them. I just say, fine, whatever. I disengage with the piece. I'll run whatever the fuck they want.
Yeah.
And I never write for them again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. it's not worth it.
Life is too short to have to
life
go through
is
this.
Life is too short to go through these things. All writing and publishing is a collaborative process.
It is. It's a two-way street.
And if you find somebody who you know that you should not collaborate again with, don't just walk away.
Right.
I mean, just, you know, move on.
Right.
But PJ was, God, he was great. He was great. He was a good guy, and he could write this. He could write all different kinds of stuff.
Yes.
I hate it when people talk about him as a humorist, actually, because it's like I just don't think of him that way.
He was a great reporter.
He was a good reporter. He was a good travel writer. He was a good observer. He could profile people. Like he was not. I think it is a very impoverished view of PJ as like, ooh, America's great humorist.
America's great conservative humorist.
And the other thing was, conservative humorist. He was so interesting, and he had so many interesting stories and knew so many famous people, but he, you know, if you wanted to talk to him about something complete, whatever you wanted to talk about, he was perfectly content talking about what you wanted to talk about. Whereas like, if I were him, I'd be like, oh, you know, that, you know, let me find a way to bring it back to you. Well, speaking of which, you know, I remember when John Hughes was telling me after the Breakfast Club, you know, and he's like, wow. But, you know, or, you know, his first in-laws, were, Sidney Lumet and Lena and the singer Lena Horne. And, I remember him mentioning how he went in to, have a drink, with his then father-in-law. And who was there hanging out in at the bar in the backyard but Sean Connery? And so
that's funny.
He goes over. They said it was a really nice guy. And PJ asked him, and this is probably late 70s, early 80s, late 70s. And he asked him, what movie did you enjoy the most making? And you know what he said? So this
Zoltan.
This is before The Untouchables. And he said, Thunderbolt. No, I'm just kidding. He didn't say that. He said, The Wind and the Lion.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know who directed that? That
Milius.
Is, yes, John Milius. Yeah. That's funny. That he enjoyed that. For me, I lived in the same building as PJ did for 10 years.
The Kennedy Warren. Where it all happened.
And where it all happened. Christine Rosen was there. The Eberstadts, the Fergusons, the Caldwells, Naomi Wolf, Ann Coulter. But when I got there, a lot of those folks had left. The Fergusons, Caldwells, and Eberstadts had left. But Ann Coulter was still there. And Mandy Grunwald, Matt Cooper, and PJ. So I was in 906. I had the studio apartment. And PJ was in 801, so we inevitably would run into each other. And then over the years, you know, lunches and dinners and things. But I'd say one of my fondest memories was I take the summer solstice very seriously because I hate to be inside. It's the longest day of the year. So I'm like, I got to be outside as much as possible to enjoy the sun. It's June 21st, right? I'm one with Nate. I'm very paganistic that way, Sonny. I know.
Yeah, that's very like midsummer.
Yeah, it's midsummer. I know. I got to get into that
midsummer?
Movie. I know. I should
just go out and find
movie.
A virgin.
Vic
spend the day
out.
With.
Vic builds a wicker man.
Out. The secret's out.
Vic builds a wicker man on top of the
right.
Kennedy Warren been, and burns it. And if it's a good burning,
right, it's a good
the crops thing. In D.C. are
that's right.
Know,
no, I mean, you know, it's a little
high as an elephant's eye.
It's a side of me that I rarely discuss, really, where I'm one with nature and I have my.
I had no idea. This is all very much new.
Absolutely,
to me.
You know.
You and your.
Yeah, no, I carry. I have the sundial. And I'm just kidding. Okay. So anyway, I go upstairs. I said, I'm going to do some reading. I got out of work early and said, let me, I know, shocking.
That's not surprising.
That's not surprising.
That is.
So I go up, the Kennedy Warren has a sun deck. So I go upstairs and PJ was up there with his wife, Tina, and Mary Eberstadt. And they were having, you know, drinks and snacks and things like that. So I went up and I said, oh, hi. I just said hi to them and said, you know, Libby, they have a little lounge here. Let me just read up there. And they said, no, you got to come over. Come on. I said, no. But they insisted. So I come over. You know, what am I supposed to do? Actually, now there's the four of us.
Vote Mattis.
Yeah, thank you, Vote Mattis. And so,
no buttons.
And I look around and I say, oh, what do we have here? You know, and the ladies had white wine. PJ had brought up a bottle of Oban scotch. And had cracked it open. I said, ooh. I said, you know, I've never had that before. So, well, as luck would have it, we have extra glasses. So
just inviting himself in.
Yeah. So we did. And cigarillos, because that's what PJ loved to smoke with those little brand. The little cigar. I like them, too, because they're much more manageable than cigars. I know it's not ideal, but I like them. So cigarillos and Oban scotch. And I think we made our way to about half the bottle. And then we took an intermission, and I said, bathroom, because there's no bathroom on the side. I said, let's go bathroom break.
To the side of the building.
I could have done that into Klingle Valley, and then I said, I'll be back. So then I went.
Can I get the Zubar from here?
And that's right. Yes, the Zubar. Very good, JVL, the Zubar. God. So I went downstairs, and at that time, since we were still fairly newlyweds, I think we'd been married for maybe less than a year, I still had a small bar.
You banged it out real
bar.
Quick, and then you went back.
Yes, really quick. Of course, Kate was still working on the Hill. So I went downstairs and I said, you know, what do I have? And a friend had given us as a wedding gift a bottle of Macallan. So I said, I haven't opened this up, but you know, what the hell? You know, hang out with PJ and get this bottle of Macallan. So now I brought up the Macallan, and now there's the Macallan and the Oban. And at this point, at some point, Mary left, Tina left, and it was just us. And it was no longer daylight. It was now darkness. And it was and both bottles made it to about the halfway point. So basically we split a bottle is I think at the end of the day, but that was, and we, I think we talked about Jan Wenner and lots of other things, but that, you know what?
And he gave said, me, Vic, you're such a great writer. It gave me piece you wrote last week.
And that's my memory. And that's my memory of PJ, who said, I'm amazing at drinking and writing. And that's my memory of him. That's my memory of him.
After the bottle of liquor, all I remember is PJ saying how much he loved my stuff.
Yes, I will say this. The idea, it sounds shocking, and maybe Sonny can relate to this. We'll find out. But the idea of, oh my gosh, you know, two people finish a bottle of scotch, that's crazy. It's not so crazy. It's actually quite doable in the span of a couple hours. Jonathan's not saying anything.
No,
but
no.
Sonny,
a friend of mine here in Dallas, one of my very few friends here in Dallas, came over one night with a bottle of tin cup.
Oh yeah, the bourbon
whiskey, bourbon, mm-hmm. whatever it is. I think it's a bourbon, tin cup bourbon, and between the two of us, we drank the whole bottle. And he was exceptionally drunk, and called an Uber or Lyft or whatever. And when he got back to his apartment, he got robbed. He got robbed. And I, to this day, am convinced that the Lyft driver called ahead and was like, I got one.
So shit-faced.
I got a guy.
Yeah, he's going to go.
Because
he lived in an
apartment complex with like outdoor doors. Mm. And somebody rolled up on him and was like, you know, give us your keys, give us your wallet, stole his car.
Oh, my gosh.
Like got away with it. But the point of the story here is that it is certainly possible to drink a bottle of liquor between two people and, you know, not die.
Just make sure you both live in the Kennedy Warren.
I remember, yeah, because you just have to get to the elevator. Oh, there were stairs involved, and that was pretty scary, actually, because we did take stairs. Because it's like from 12, 11, 10, 9, I was like, I'll see you, bye, you know, and just, you know, convinced that, no, I don't have a problem. I'm completely fine, you know, I mean, to this day. So, I mean, you know, half a bottle every day is okay. You know,
yeah.
Kidding.
Sure.
Honestly, kidding. Lifetime, I don't think I've bought one bottle of scotch for my house. Mm-hmm. And I don't
it's
think
still
it's,
there.
Well, of course it's still there, but I'm saying I don't think it's halfway done. This bottle's got to be 13 years old.
That's not how they age.
No.
You have to, it's,
it doesn't count. Once it's in the bottle, it doesn't count.
I'm not saying this because I think I'm making it better. I'm just telling you that that's the rate at which it is drunk.
I think that the key to finishing a bottle is when you do not intend to finish the bottle. If you ever go into like, oh, we're going to be so crazy tonight, we're just going to drink it. I think it's much harder to do that than it's very spontaneous just to have another drink and suddenly it's done.
Pouring,
and be able to say that you don't have a problem is okay too.
Well, you start out with just the tip. Yeah. It's the just the tip theory of drinking.
I lost my transition here, but I was going to say denial. the joke was that denial is more than just a river in Egypt. Speaking of which, over the weekend, death.
I think we can figure out where that was going.
Yeah. Death on the Nile sailed to the top of the box office with $12.9 million. Followed by Jackass Forever with $8.1 million. And in third place, Marry Me with $7.9 million. Box office thoughts really quickly. What is Marry Me? Oh, that's a romance?
Yeah, it's a rom-com.
J-Lo.
J-Lo and Owen Wilson. So it actually doesn't sound terrible. It sounds like a very traditional Hollywood rom-com. I have no interest in seeing it, obviously.
We don't do rom-coms on the show.
Here's a rom-com we have to do. The Sandra Bullock, Channing Tatum movie.
That does I saw the trailer. Amazing.
My only concern about that trailer is that I feel like I saw the whole movie. But anyway.
So what? It's like a better Romancing the Stone. It looks fantastic.
It does. Yeah. Yes. Go ahead, Sonny.
Death on the Nile did okay. I don't know. I mean, I feel like this is one of these movies that got delayed so many times people thought it had come out already. I literally heard that from people. They were like, didn't this come out 2 years ago? And it was supposed to. Supposed to, but
a lot of trailers
just came out now. Jackass declined about what was expected. The big news is that Spider-Man No Way Home passed Avatar on the domestic box office list. Huge hit. Huge,
where is that? Where is it? Where does it stand now? What number is it? Is it?
It is at 761 million or something like that domestic, and then 1.88 billion. Some absurd number like that. So it is. It probably won't hit 800 million domestic. And it probably won't hit 2 billion. Overseas,
where's Titanic in this? Is it still
Titanic? Titanic is higher on the foreign and domestic.
Got it.
But it is lower on the domestic. I think Spider-Man No Way Home is 100 million past Titanic now.
Wow.
Or so. Okay. I mean,
it's great.
It's not going to, I mean, it's still very funny to think about. Like Star Wars, The Force Awakens, episode 7 whatever the full title of that movie is. That is still the highest grossing domestic film of all time by a lot. That movie grossed 900 some million dollars. Yeah. I mean, American audiences love that movie. You know who didn't love it? The Chinese did not care for it. Did not go see it.
They don't like any Star Wars.
They do not. They do not like
the Star Wars.
The
Chinese
no.
audiences do not like the Star Wars. They do not like Star Wars 1 or Star Wars 7 or Star Wars 9.
No. By the way, speaking of Star Wars and knockoffs and such, JVL, over the weekend, I met my brother-in-law's brother-in-law, if that makes any sense, Bill Dwyer's brother-in-law. Sure. And he said, thank you very much, because through you, he's gotten into Lepin.
Oh, good.
That's it.
Hey, just a brief Star Wars interlude. Yeah. I actually spent for the first time in ever 30 minutes on the Oculus doing a video game, and it's the Star Wars Darth Vader video game, and it blew my fucking mind. So, Vic, we need to have...
Right.
I am dead serious. We need a play date, because you are going to go nuts for this thing.
Wow. Okay. Good. There. Yeah, let me. When we first, we must have done Force Awakens for the substandard sub, didn't we? That was a big one, I think.
Yeah, I think you talked yourself into believing that you
liked it. Was great. I was going to say, did we? Did we say it was great at the time, or did we convince ourselves, or did we think it was bad because of? No, that's not.
Star Wars and Force Awakens was fine. It was a fine soft reboot.
Oh yeah, it was fine.
It was setting the table for a series that went totally off the rails. I mean, I have no issues with Star Wars and Force Awakens. Mm-hmm. It is not like high art. It is not a great movie, mm-hmm. but it is like a totally fine table setter. And they had no idea what to do with the series after that. They just didn't know what to do with
it. So here's something I find interesting about Force Awakens, though. Normally, movies are either punished or rewarded for the sins or accomplishments of their predecessors. Mm-hmm. And Star Wars Force Awakens was rewarded for the sins of the prequels. And people hated the prequels so much that an explicit break with them,
yes.
which is what The Force this Awakens was. Promised, mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. like, look, we're going to give you Han and Chewie.
Yeah.
Look,
J.J. Abrams.
Look, we're going to get, we know,
Princess
we,
Leia.
We know we were bad dogs. Right. We rubbed our noses in it, and we are not going to do that again.
The dialogue.
And an explicit break with it caused audiences to reward them. Mm-hmm. That is, mm-hmm. that's interesting.
Yeah.
But, however, an explicit break with The Last Jedi was not rewarded. The box office on Rise of Skywalker bad. Very bad.
Yes.
And the
box because the fans
the
really
Jedi,
loved Rian Johnson's vision.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I liked Rose.
That sounds right.
I thought Rose was compelling.
Nobody liked Rose.
Poor Rose.
Stop it.
Okay.
Sonny, Death on the Nile. How about a big boy review?
Death on the Nile.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler. We're going to be talking about what happens in this 60-year-old book. So, slash series of movies.
It was a book.
Death on the Nile is Kenneth Branagh's sequel to Murder on the Orient Express. Like it is, like its predecessor, he directed stars in both. What is interesting about this movie is that it starts with a 5-minute prologue about the origin story of Hercule Poirot's mustache.
Yes.
Sure. And then we get into the meat of the plot, and it is, I'm curious to get Vic's read on this because it feels like the way I described it in my review is that it is kind of fake convoluted. It is not actually that convoluted. Mm-hmm. It's pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. It's about a very wealthy heiress who steals the man of another woman. And that causes a whole bunch of problems when she tries to go on her honeymoon. There are murders, and then the murders are solved. And if you can't figure out what happened in the murder, if you can't figure out who the murderer is, like, while the murder is actually taking place, you have never seen a murder mystery before. It was, like, the most obvious. I'm not the sort of person
How
who...
How dare you make these presumptions?
But here's the thing is, I'm not actually the sort of person who, like, tries to guess the solution as the movie is happening. And I, like, when the thing was happening, I was like, oh, this, so in the, from the very first scene, and here's the very first scene of the, like, the actual meat of the movie. It takes place in a nightclub where Hercule Poirot has shown up, and is seeing this fabulously wealthy woman, Lynette Ridgway, who's played by Gal Gadot in this film, meets up with one of her friends, who is played by, Emma Mackey, who I've never seen in anything before. Striking. Striking woman.
Jacqueline.
What's Jacqueline?
Beaufort.
Thank you.
Beaufort.
And in between these two women is Armie Hammer, basically. I'm not even going to bother with his name.
Simon.
And Simon, thank you. It is very, very obvious. Well, look, I don't want to actually, like, just jump in and spoil it, but it is very obvious what's going on with that thruple that Simon. What is his name? Simon.
Do we need his last name?
It's
going to drive me crazy because it's actually a good character name. But anyway, Simon leaves Emmy Mackey and goes to Gal Gadot. And if you can't see the setup here, I don't know how to help you. Gal Gadot and Armie Hammer go on their honeymoon. Simon Doyle, thank you. Emma Mackey keeps showing up, and they eventually are like, all right, we're just going to rent out this whole luxury liner. We're going to go down the Nile. We're going to get out of here. And she's there again.
Yes.
Murders take place.
All of
the sudden, it turns into what this movie really is a movie about class, and it's a movie about frustrations, economic and otherwise, between the upper and lower classes. And in that sense, I actually really like this movie. I'm being kind of weirdly snarky and dismissive about a movie that I actually liked quite a bit. The things I did not like about it are all technical. They're all technical. I mean, like the opening mustache bit and the closing scene where he has shaved the mustache, spoilers. I felt totally unnecessary. I didn't care for any of that. Structurally, it feels just all wrong for the movie. But the real technical issue with this film is that it looks incredibly cheap. It looks,
CGI, because they meant to film it in Egypt, but they didn't.
So they shot it all on sound stages. And any shot where the exterior is in the background.
Mm-hmm.
So like when, for instance, there's this very great shot of Emma Mackey, the Jacqueline character. She's walking up a flight of steps. She's wearing this like smoking hot dress. Mm-hmm. She's just like, she just looks total bombshell. Mm-hmm. Right. And she looks like a femme fatale and like, oh my God, look at her.
Dress.
And like, All I could see was the glaring shadow problems off the CGI background. Mm-hmm. The lighting was all wrong. The shadows were all wrong. The penumbra of the light was all wrong. It was just like everything about it was wrong. And this happens again and again and again in the movie. There are a couple shots on the Karnak where like the characters are leaning against the rails and looking out into the Nile River, and the Nile River itself looks like a PS3 quality cutscene of a river.
That's not good.
It's really bad.
When the gun
bad.
Goes under the water and yeah. it's dripping really down. Really bad. That's not good.
It's really bad. Like, the Karnak itself, like, obviously they can't create a working... It would be very, very expensive to create
the BBC
a working replica
of a steamship
of the Karnak.
Yes,
the BBC did it.
Whatever. Point is, it would be...
And that was a good point. I like that guy, too. He's good.
They didn't do that here. And so, like, anytime you see the Karnak on the river, it looks super fake. And they have, like, fake sailboats around it. It's just, like, it all looks terrible.
I felt the
but
same
when the camera turns around, when the camera turns around and when Kenneth Branagh is shooting just the, like, the actual ship, when he's, like, tracking along and shooting the actual ship, which is real. These are, like, exterior sets that have been built. It looks good. It looks good and not fake and not
real
terrible.
Real has always been.
And I just like, it was very frustrating to watch because I liked this movie a lot. I really did. Mm-hmm. I found it entertaining, even though it was like totally obvious what was happening in it. And there is like such a lack of care with the CGI work that it drove me a little bit crazy. So anyway, that's my review is I liked it, but it is like weirdly shoddy in very, very grating ways.
Yeah. I mean, it's a terrible thing when they can try, because they do not achieve the same effect, obviously. But, you know, the terrible thing about the CGI route is any moment you can say, hey, we can have a magic hour throughout this whole movie, you know, and just create that color, even though it's not the same color, and your eyes pick up on this stuff, and it's just jarring. JVL, are you a reader of Agatha Christie at all, or
I think
you're muted?
It's because I was typing as I was looking up something. Yeah, I'm a sucker for British murder mysteries. I'm a sucker for all of the Agatha Christie movies and books from Miss Marple through Poirot. I devour the BBC productions of these. In 2004, the BBC did a film. I mean, it was for BBC, but it was a film in the way that, like, you know, the Granada things did Brideshead Revisited. So it's a big budget for TV. Big budget. And, you know, it's shot on location in Egypt, and they have a riverboat.
Makes a big difference.
And they just, you know. But here's the thing. It doesn't look as cinematic and beautiful, but it also looks better. And it's like all those things that are bothering you, right? You don't have these grand sweeping shots because they don't have drones yet and, you know, they're not flying helicopters and stuff. But it looks, I just like it better. So I love all of these things. And Death on the Nile is my single favorite of all of them. And so this is, you know, I have, within the last year, I have both reread the book and rewatched the 2004 David Suchet version.
Yeah, I like that actor.
And so I have so many thoughts, but Victorino, I am curious to know what you think.
Well, it's interesting. So it did pretty well on the quadrants.
Did it?
Yeah. The plot is a B+. Now, here's why. On the one hand, a lot of people's names. It's very hard to keep track of these people. I just can't. You know, they're mentioning people's names. I don't know who's Finley and Book and this and that. It's too crazy. But
Book.
But and the singer and then the niece. And it's just too many names. However, it helped. It got a boost in the grade because at the end, when Poirot's explanation and they reconstruct everything. Oh yes, thank you. Okay, now it all makes sense. Okay, that's one thing. However, you were asking me, Sonny, about what I thought in terms of following the plot. There was a scene early on, besides the one in the club, where I get Simon is supposed to be very upset about something, and I just didn't buy that he was really upset. And the thought already crossed my mind that he's still in love with the other woman, and this is a setup for to get the money from Gal Gadot. And so it was not really a surprise.
from the jump, it is just so obvious. Yeah. Like,
I mean, I'll say it's crossed my mind. I said it could be, if they wanted to be interesting, it could be somebody else. But in my mind, I thought, I can see that this is, it could be this. And the other thing is, I had not read the book. However, I did see the night as a kid. I was probably 8. But I saw on HBO the 1978
with
version.
A young Maggie Smith.
Yes.
Right, yeah. Totally dishy
old.
Maggie Smith.
But she was still
old. No, she's
funny.
Not old.
And I
she's
think
like
Betty
30.
Davis was in that too. It was crazy. Yeah. And that's,
she's old.
That's
George Kennedy.
Yes. And that's the Peter Ustinov, Hercule Poirot with David Niven. And it's funny because some of the violence there, I remember it bothered me. Oddly, it just disturbed me about because it's like a gunshot to the head, and it kind of bothered me in a weird way as a child. Shocking. Duration is a B. I thought it was fine. Action and violence, again, I give it a B+. It's not a lot, but it's interesting. It's interesting violence. I mean, it's on a boat. I mean, and the
get
other
to the money shot here.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, sex nudity is a D, but it's not an F, okay. And I'll tell you why it's not an F. Because Gal Gadot bending over at Abu Simbel, great shot. And
when,
good for her. You're never going to see her
naked.
When Gal Gadot
recites Anthony and Cleopatra and
yes.
is asking to get
At
ridden
Abu Simbel,
from behind.
It's fantastic.
That didn't,
yeah.
didn't
no, that's why,
vault
that's why,
you up to an A+?
Well, because they're not having any sex and there's no nudity. But
well,
I
they're about
to. A D.
The whole dirty dancing scene.
Yeah,
in the
that opening dance scene. That didn't, that's a D for you?
I liked it.
Basically everything Emma Mackey is wearing.
Is there sex or is there nudity? It's a strict constructionist interpretation.
Sonny, wasn't it like 3 weeks ago that we said, and he was like, well, I'm going to give it a B+ because it's PG-13. You can't
expect
more.
It's a PG-13 movie.
Oh, we mean after we fell? After we fell, they're actually doing it. You're
yeah,
not
that's right,
anybody.
And there's no nudity.
There's nobody. That,
no nudity
I imagined
in that movie.
It. In my mind, there was nudity. I was pretty sure I saw something in the hot tub.
The quadrants are a lie.
There's no hot
the
tub scene like that.
Quadrants are a lie.
Yeah, there's no hot tub scene here, you know? So, no. Okay. I liked it better than Murder on the Orient Express. I thought Murder on the Orient Express
this is
was
way
good.
Better than Murder on
so,
the Orient Express. Just the book is better. Everything about the story is better than
you
Murder
disagree,
on the Orient.
I think the Kenneth Branagh Murder on the Orient Express is much better than this.
No, I like this better. I like the opening. I thought it was good. Although, here's what's interesting. I didn't realize that plastic surgery was that good in the 1920s when they were able to repair his face because he's missing a chunk of his face.
I don't believe that is canon, actually. I think this is a totally new interpretation
all,
of Poirot.
Well, but it's clearly Kenneth Branagh saying, we need to give Hercule Poirot a story. He needs to be the anchor of this film. And, like, I think that's wrong, actually. I think that is a wrong interpretation of how these movies work. I don't really care about Hercule Poirot, except for the fact that he's, like, weird and kind of like, fastidious. And, like, whatever, like, works to make him seem like a reasonable person to solve these mysteries, that's fine. But, like, he shouldn't be the story.
So, So I believe that what that serves in this is trying to get around a question about Poirot's. This is a movie about love, not about class, and the story itself is about love as well, and it is dealt with vis-a-vis Poirot very specifically in the book, which is that none of those things have ever touched his life, and he regrets it. But he can't change it because that's just not who he was. And so Kenneth Branagh's answer to that is he loved once and he loved so deeply and then he lost. And that's why he has become something new. And, you know, I don't mind that. It's not my favorite interpretation of Poirot, but I don't begrudge him it. The problem.
I would totally choose Jacqueline, by the way. Go ahead.
Well, the problem with this version is that it actually centers on Lynette. And not Jacqueline. And Jacqueline actually gets very little screen time. And when she is, in fact, the main character. Mm-hmm. And this movie, this interpretation of it takes Lynette Ridgway. And it makes her the lead. And in doing so, it creates a couple problems. The first of which is that it makes Lynette Ridgway entirely sympathetic. So in this version of the story, Lynette Ridgway is this, she's a girl boss and she's together. And yeah. the problem is she just fell in love with this guy, and the heart wants what it wants.
I strongly disagree with this read on her, but keep going. Keep going.
And part of that, I think, is the problem with casting Gal Gadot as Lynette Ridgway, because Gal Gadot is just winning. And I'm sorry.
Right. She's like, Wonder Woman.
You look at that smile on her, and, you know, like she does not look like a bad person.
No.
She looks like a really good person.
I find her very intimidating.
So
that's why I choose the smaller
one. So you wind up.
Smaller one. Sorry. I mean, the other one.
Focusing on Lynette, and it's also because you have Gal Gadot, this big movie star. Emily Blunt in the 2004 played Lynette Ridgway in 2004. Yeah, and her portrayal is in the writing, and that is much, much closer to the book, which is that Lynette Ridgway scooped Simon up in this. Like, you know, Simon has made made his move on poor Gal Gadot, and she fell in love, and what was she to do? In the book and in the 2004 version of this, Lynette meets Simon and just kind of thinks, yeah, I could have that. I'll take it. And takes him from Jacqueline, her friend, just because she can. And then they wind up married, but she's not like crazy into it anyway. You know, like she's sort of into it, but not crazy into it. And she's kind of a bad person. She treats Poirot like the help. You know, she does not go to him like, oh, I'm so scared. She goes to him like, this woman is a horrible annoyance to me. You are like a policeman. I'll pay you whatever you want. Go, just make it go away. And by not having any of that, and making Lynette the centerpiece here, we miss out on Jacqueline. And Jacqueline is a fabulous character. And here she is sort of depowered and shoved into the background and is not half as interesting as she is in the book, where she herself has no interest in the money. She is the one who is utterly besotted and is the one who has been moved into all of this by love, because she's in love with this guy, Simon, and Simon is no good. Simon is this idiot and this layabout, and he's the one who fucks up the, like, he's the one who's like, no, we can't get married because I got to have money. And so she comes up with the idea, okay, well, this is how we'll get it. And she comes up with a plan that is perfect, and Simon fucks it up because he decides he's going to improve on her plan. And he goes, and that is actually totally cut out of this. So in the book, he goes, and after shooting
The plot would have dropped Lynette, if they
after shooting Lynette, he puts his finger in her blood and draws a J on the wall next to her.
You know what?
I think in the 1978 version, something
like that happened. Well,
that's because it's in the story. And the idea is that, again, so Simon has fucked all this up because he is such an idiot. And poor Jacqueline then is forced into all, you know, poor Jacqueline has to kill the maid then, which she has no interest in doing. She has to kill, in the book, she kills this woman who's a novelist, not a singer. Anyway, unimportant. But the point is, Jacqueline is then dragged down this path by her love of Simon. And she is the one who, you know, in the Kenneth Branagh version, everybody's in love and everybody's being pulled this way and that by love. But in the book, there's only one person who is trapped by love, and it's Jacqueline.
I feel like she could have been played by Marion Cotillard. But anyway.
Yes.
She has that look certainly.
Sonny, did you see a completely different movie?
I have to strongly disagree with this read on
Lynette?
On Lynette and Gal Gadot and how this all plays out, because I agree with you. At the beginning of the film, Gal Gadot is like kind of like very standard movie star, like winning, right? Like she's just a winning presence and personality. Everybody wants to be around her, but once she is killed, spoiler, once she is killed in the film and everybody starts talking about the ways that Lynette has ruined her life, it takes on a much different cast, I think. I think it takes on like a much more sinister cast.
I think that is only done in some attempt to make it look like these other people are plausible murderers.
Oh, no. See, I think this movie is playing to Gal Gadot's strengths, which are as kind of almost a clueless ice queen type. And I think she's actually really good in this movie. And I think, I feel like your read on Lynette in this is wrong. I mean, like, the story that the maid tells about how Lynette, like, forced her to, you know, like, bribed her, you know, would-be husband, and he took the money and ran, and then Lynette was like, see, he was no good. Like, all of, like, I think your read on this is wrong. I have to strongly push back.
But there's too much Lynette is the point. The movie gives too much to her and does not spend nearly enough with Jacqueline, who again is the most interesting character. And it also again it makes her a weaker character. That, you know, in the end, when at the denouement, when she and Simon are he's the one who like pulls the gun and is trying to figure out a way to fight it out, and then she kills them both. Well, the way it happens in the book is. They're when Poirot figures it out, he has no proof of any of this stuff. And Simon, because he's a weakling and an idiot, just confesses. Like they were, even with his freelancing, they're going to get away with it. But Simon confesses. And Jacqueline is just like, oh my God, he's ruined our lives. And so they, you know, the boat docks and they're being led off by the police. And she has gone and stolen a gun. And she goes to kiss him as he's being pulled off on a stretcher because his leg is shattered. And she shoots him first and then shoots herself. And Poirot is watching the entire thing and he knows it's going to happen. And he lets it happen anyway because he himself, he is very fond of Jacqueline because he has recognized from the very beginning that this is what, you know, this is what she was heading to. This was the path she was on. And there's this great moment where one of my favorite lines in all of like Agatha Christiedom, when he first is meeting with Jacqueline at the hotel, before they're on the boat and he's gone to her to try to warn her off. And he says to her, "Bury your dead, mademoiselle." It's just this beautiful phrase of how to, like, you know, you got to move on from this, because he thinks that she, that it's real. And then as they're talking, he understands even there that this is not what it seems and that she is being pushed into some very dangerous pathway by passion and love here. And it's great. It's so great. I wish that this version of the movie is fine. I enjoyed it. I did not dislike it, but if anybody listening to this likes this stuff, go read the book, which is, I think, Agatha Christie's best, or go watch the 2004 David Suchet version of this, which is absolutely phenomenal.
Is the book better than Murder on the Orient Express?
I think so. It's sexy. It's.
I do not care for that book. I found that
Murder
book
on the Orient Express.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think that. I think it Murder on the. I've never understood why Murder on the Orient Express became the totem it did. I think it's just because of the solution that everybody did it. Like, yeah. I think that's it. Just the who did it? Everybody did it, and so it became just a byword for what British mysteries are like.
Yeah.
Everybody should go do it. It's again, and the book is like sexy and cool, and it's great.
One of the other reasons I thought that it wouldn't be the other suspects is because they spend little time on the other suspects. And it's like, you know,
because too much
about
time with Lynette. This is, yeah, again.
So I'm like, well, it would be surprising if it was the lawyer.
Both the book and the 2004 spend a lot more time with everybody else in the cast. And the more you spend with those characters, the more plausible. You always figure something's going on with Simon and Jacqueline, but you can't figure out what it is or how they've done it. Also, Armie Hammer is the one person I think who's miscast in this. Mm. Russell Brand is great.
It's so weird to see Russell Brand not being Russell Brand.
I loved him.
I feel like everybody's great in this, though. I mean, I feel like this is the sort of movie that Armie Hammer is supposed to. This is the sort of movie that Armie Hammer is supposed to play. He is supposed to be a like very attractive, slightly dumb, but prone to flashes of very vicious anger.
He's not quite charming enough, though.
I've always liked Armie Hammer.
Tom Bateman, much more. So Tom Bateman, who played Book.
Yeah, sure.
He plays Book.
He was the villain in Cold Pursuit.
He was the villain in Cold, but he would have been perfect in this role had he not been cast in Murder on the Orient Express.
The original one.
Yeah. Right. I mean, his level of charm is what is required of the Simon Doyle character.
Book.
Yeah.
I kind of felt like he might have been a suspect, because what are the odds that he presides over two murder mysteries where people are where the killer is in the same room? That's terrible luck. That's suspicious. The original, not the original, the 1978 Death on the Nile, Jacqueline was played by Mia Farrow. But Simon Doyle was played by a Brit B actor named, I'm sure John Pod is now screaming because he'll know what it is. Yes, yes, it's Simon McCorkindale, who was not only in Jaws 3D, he had the grenade inside the Jaws, but also he was in a short-lived TV series in the 80s called Manimal. Where he could change.
Manimal.
Simon, he was Manimal?
He was Manimal, and he was Simon Doyle.
Wow.
Yeah. So there you go. Okay. Do we have any other thoughts on this?
No, people, go yeah. Anybody, yeah, go to Amazon and buy, I think it's $9.
Well, the original, the 1978 one, is on Criterion Channel right now. I think.
Really?
People want to go
see
it.
Go get the one with Emily Blunt.
Yeah.
Emily Blunt is fantastic.
I'm a big fan of hers.
So good.
In general. Spirit of the week, corrections, shout outs.
I think everything. Our spirit of the week is whatever you drank with PJ.
Oban and McKellen. That is all the time we're giving to this episode. Questions, comments, compliments, tweet us at SunnyBunch, at Victorina Mattis. Again, be sure to subscribe to us on Patreon. Just go to subbeacon.com. We're there. Tell your friends. Until next time.
You know, it is weirdly sad. I don't know, fitting is the wrong word, but it is weirdly sad that PJ O'Rourke and Ivan Reitman died in the same week. Ivan Reitman, the director.
Really? I missed that.
Ivan Reitman
died.
Ivan Reitman died. On Super Bowl Sunday.
Oh, I totally
I wrote an obituary about him.
I totally missed that. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, Ivan Reitman died. The director of Ghostbusters, Stripes, Kindergarten Cop.
Great director.
You know, Junior Twins. Mm-hmm.
Dave.
I mean, all sorts of great stuff. But he is also of the National Lampoon comedy tree. He was a producer on Animal House. He was in with all those guys. Mm-hmm. I think he maybe worked on the radio show or something, but he had some tie to the National Lampoon family, which of course PJ also did.
Yeah,
he was editor
absolutely.
Of National Lampoon magazine. And like losing both of those guys in a, mm-hmm. 2 day period is like, it is for me, Ivan Reitman was one of the first directors whose name I recognized and was like, when I go to see an Ivan Reitman picture, it's going to be funny and it's going to be an interesting comedy.
Absolutely.
And PJ was one of the first writers whose name I was like, if I am reading a PJ or work piece, it will be funny, but it will also be, as JVL mentioned, he's not pigeonholing him as a humorist is wrong, but it will be funny in addition to
everything else,
poignant and trenchant and all that. And like, losing both of those guys in a 2 day stretch is like, I had the foundations of my like comic sensibility chopped out from under me all at once.
Yeah.
I just like, it's a real blow.
You know,
I can't believe you guys didn't see.
I missed that.
Of course I saw this. Listen, all right. We can't end on this downer.
I was going to say, who PJ loved talking about was Doug Kenny. And that's another from that world.
Guy. Yeah.
Now they're all together. But I was going to say, so we don't end it on a down note, if I may, or no, JVL, you have.
I have some, but I can. I'll do it at the top of the Reacher episode because our bonus episode is about Reacher. So you go ahead.
Yes, very good. Another Poirot with muscles, as I call it. Okay, so was I the only one who got very nervous watching on screen in Death in the Nile, Army Hammer? Whenever he would like put his mouth on Gail Gadot.
Oh, shush. Oh, come on. Shush.
I feel like he's talking about a role he could sink his teeth into.
No, that's all lies. That's all lies.
Really?
And
it was like a little.
I'm sure it's fine.